The Han Agent, Science Thriller by Amy Rogers, read by Amy Rogers. Prologue, Part 2 of 2. Masaji emerged on the windowless outer side of Row Block, where the small military city of Pingfan sprawled across the desolate flats, ringed by earthen walls and barbed wire. In accordance with his brother's orders, the city was being razed. Only a few dozen buildings remained standing, including his private home, where his wife and four children, three of them born in Manchukuo, awaited evacuation. A thick cloud of dust obscured the hot afternoon sun. Through the haze, Masaji surveyed the dismantling of his family's great achievement. Pingfan was his brother Shiro's brainchild, the crown jewel in Unit 731's extensive biological warfare research program in occupied China. Thousands of Japanese scientists, physicians, soldiers, and their families had lived here. Behind Pingfan's secrecy and security walls, Japanese women tended gardens. Japanese children went to school. There was a swimming pool, a bar, and other amenities that had made it a reasonably pleasant place to work during wartime. Pleasant for the Japanese residents, that is. He headed for home. His first priority was to get the documents loaded and on their way. Then he and his family would leave Pingfan together. A murky rivulet seeped from the edge of Row Block. Glancing toward the source, he saw a column of pitch-black smoke rising from the hidden courtyard. The Maruta were burning. He could smell it now, too. Row Block was empty. His eye caught movement near the ground. Something broad and low writhed over the bare dirt like a living blanket. The blanket spread with a scrabbling, scratching sound and swept toward him. He leaped over the rivulet and turned to get out of the way. Rats. Escaped from one of Pingfan's austere research laboratories, the rodents were desperately seeking cover. Hundreds of them flowed past, a seething river of fur and long, bald tails. They splashed through the polluted stream, leaving a thousand paw-shaped puddles in their wake. He swore aloud. He had no fear of the common rat, but these were no ordinary wild rats. They were infested with fleas that carried bubonic plague. General Ishii had ordered the rats released into a nearby Chinese city, not inside Pingfan. Someone had made a mistake. The herd of rats disappeared into a pile of rubble. He resumed walking. He would waste no worry on the plague-carrying fleas. He and his family would soon be far away, and Unit 731's field trials in Ningbo and other Chinese cities had proved the plague-infested rats weren't as dangerous as hoped. The Black Death killed people, but it lacked the potency and immediacy of, say, a uranium bomb. The American bomb, he thought again. Was it true? Compared to that, the Ishii's project had failed completely. Unit 731's goal was to create a living weapon using microorganisms, a germ weapon that would slay Japan's enemies and allow the island nation to conquer and rule all of East Asia and the Pacific. The military had given his brilliant brother Shiro everything he asked for. Money, secrecy, exemption from any human laws. The Kempeitai secret police had supplied them with test subjects from the local Chinese population and prisoners of war, mostly Russians. Masaji and the unit's many other scientists had answered questions none had dared to even ask before. Questions about shrapnel wounds and burns and amputation. Questions about infectious disease and how to turn bacteria into weapons. And yet, a grand weapon, something like the Americans, remained beyond their grasp. If they only had more time. Tires crunched gravel behind him. An armored truck passed him and came to a stop at his house just ahead. The truck dwarfed the small Type 95 Kurogani scout car already parked there. Trucks like this one delivered Maruta, rounded up from the streets and prisons of Harbin. Fittingly, the logs had been transformed into paper. Through Unit 731's effort, the Maruta were now data, priceless information recorded in notebooks packed inside hundreds of crates. Data on everything from anthrax bombs to frostbite. It would take only one truck to haul away the distilled essence of thousands of Maruta. The driver climbed out of the truck. Like Masaji Ishii, he wore the insignia of a major in the Army Medical Corps. The colleagues bowed to each other. "Kame, you are no truck driver," Masaji said.
"We each do our duty," Kame said. "Kitano-san took his share of the documents on the South Manchuria Railway to Korea."
"They will find their way to the home islands."
"Or he will burn them."
Masaji fingered the smooth, rounded cyanide capsule in his pocket. The elite group of couriers would not allow a single page to fall into the hands of the Soviets or the Chinese. Each would keep his secrets until he died, whether by his own hand or the hand of another.
"Are the records complete?" Kame asked.
"Yes." He raised the final notebook he'd brought from Roblock. "Here, and in the boxes inside. Everything we learned is written down. Every experiment. Raw data. Observations. Analysis. Even today I did my duty." He gripped the notebook. "When the time is right, with this information we can resume the work." Inside the house, a baby started to cry. Kame gripped Masaji's arm.
"Unit 731 will endure. We will keep the data. We will find our weapon in biology, not physics."
A low droning sound drew both men's eyes skyward. An aircraft approaching Pingfan. Kame's expression darkened. Masaji squinted into the dry wind. "It is time to go." He knew the Imperial Japanese Army Air Service was no longer flying over Manchukuo. A curtain in the window shifted, and a child's face appeared in the corner. Masaji leaped up 2 steps and threw open the door, scattering loose papers across a tatami mat floor. His wife kneeled, holding an infant. His other children emerged from behind stacks of wooden crates. Despite the summer heat, they each held a heavy winter coat. That, and the clothes they wore, was all they could take with them. The Kurogani was designed to fit 3 men. His family of 6 would flee to the coast in it. His wife silenced the baby by offering a finger to suck. She looked at him, awaiting instructions, her face a mask of deceptive calm. His 5-year-old daughter Harumi coughed. It was odd that he even noticed. The frail girl coughed constantly, rendering him almost as deaf to the sound as she was. Of course, her deafness was physical, a consequence of one of her many bouts with sickness. "Carry the boxes out," he said. "All of you. Give Harumi the baby." Wordlessly, they set down their coats and pushed boxes toward the door. His 13-year-old son, Akihiro, carried one of his own. Masaji stepped into the sooty air and helped Kame arrange the truck's existing cargo to make room for the additional documents from his house. They both paused when a distant explosion rumbled over them. "Demolition," Masaji assured them. The men loaded the crates of documents into the truck one by one. Only 2 boxes remained on the ground
When Masaji heard aircraft again, he looked up. He counted 5 planes flying in formation, aiming toward Pingfan. "Quickly," he said. The high-pitched squeal of falling ordnance reached his ears. Explosions followed, the first ones seemingly remote. Then, like the footfalls of a monstrous runner, the blasts stepped closer and closer. His heart pounded as he lifted a crate toward Kame in the open back of the truck. A concussive wave knocked him off balance. The crate fell. Instinctively, he rolled to the ground, to the far side of the vehicle. A bomb detonated, and he curled up against the truck's huge tire and covered his head. He felt the opposite side of the truck lift as if hit by a giant fist, tilting toward him, threatening to tip over and crush him. But it didn't. Then the aerial bombers faded away to the north, taking the explosions with them. He rose to his feet. Loose papers drifted like leaves in the swirling eddies of disturbed air. He lunged into the truck. Had they lost the data? No, only the last crate was destroyed. The armored walls of the truck had protected the rest. He examined himself and found no serious injury. He looked around and discovered the Kurogani vehicle had not fared as well. His family's escape car was a crumpled and smoking heap, sprinkled with the shattered glass of windows from his house. The ringing in his ears faded, and he realized the sounds of battle had not ended. Shouts of men and machine gun fire and motorcycles. "They're coming," he said to Kame. "Chinese, Soviets, Americans, whoever, you must get this vehicle out of here." Kame gave a half bow and scrambled into the driver's seat. Masaji slammed the rear door and locked it tight. He sprinted to the driver's window and leaned in. "You know what to do? I will get through or I will die trying. If necessary, destroy the cargo first. The enemy must not get our work. Hai, Ishii-san." Kame threw the truck into reverse, spinning the wheels and scattering shredded paper as he sped away. Masaji covered his face with his sleeve and staggered back into the house. The 5 members of his family were there. Only Harumi was standing, biting her thin lower lip. Her scrawny fingers clung to a shabby doll. The other children clumped together against the windowless back wall with their mother, the baby screaming in her arms. "Get up. We go." His eldest son, Akihiro, ran to the door, but stopped short when he saw the ruined car. "Not that way," Masaji said. "Out the back." He yanked a bundle out of one of the children's arms. "Leave the coats. Leave everything." His wife met his gaze for only an instant, but it was enough. She knew. He hoped she also understood. It wasn't supposed to turn out this way. They were ahead of schedule. They thought they had days yet to evacuate. How could the enemy be here already? He herded them to the other side of the house and paused to grab his sword. They emerged outdoors into the reek and noise. "We make for Building 6," he said. Building 6 was in the opposite direction of the fighting, and he'd seen cars there just yesterday. He led them across the dusty plain, past rubble from the Japanese demolition crews, and fresh destruction from the aerial bombardment. He spied rats, but they were the least of his concerns. His daughter Harumi stumbled and wheezed. Akihiro lifted her to her feet. The baby wailed. Fortunately, they had no need for stealth. The noisy barrage of enemy fire drowned out all other sounds. Whoever the enemy was, they were getting closer. The Ishii family scrambled through a gate in a wall. They'd reached Building 6. He scanned the empty courtyard and fell to his knees. The cars were gone. His wife and children huddled against the wall to catch their breath. Not one of them had yet dared to speak. Another earth-shaking blast no further away than his house. Perhaps it was his house. The major knew his duty, but now that it came to it, his resolution faltered. He clung to the knowledge that he'd achieved the most important thing. The unit's records were safe, traveling to Japan. In the life of the Empire, his life did not matter. His duty, and the duty of his family, was to serve, to never reveal their story to the enemy. He had personally done vivisections of Chinese women, men, and children. He knew how a sharp knife parted the soft skin of a baby's belly. If the Chinese were coming, he had no reason to expect mercy. His wife's body tumbled to the side as the 8mm bullet he fired from his pistol ripped through her skull. He wanted to beg her forgiveness, but reminded himself pardon was not necessary because he was doing the right thing. The children, too stunned to move, were easy targets. His heart crumpled in his chest. If only he had cyanide pills for everyone. No, he'd seen cyanide deaths. A bullet was better. Koneko, Aiko, Akiko, the semi-automatic worked fast, their bodies piled up like logs. Then Akihiro, his eldest son, stood and spread his arms in front of little Harumi. Misaji quailed. Akihiro had always been protective of his feeble sister. His gun hand shook. "It is our duty," he said. "Please," Akihiro said. A typhoon of feelings unmanned him. He hesitated. Then the wall exploded. Flying bricks pelted him. Overwhelming pain in his face and ribs erased his psychic anguish. He found himself on his back, crushed and in agony, looking at the sky through one barely functioning eye. He could not move his right arm, and each breath was a knife in his torso. Akihiro kneeled over him. His son's eyes were impossibly wide. He pointed his father's pistol at his father's head. Misaji channeled all his will into the focus of his one eye. "Duty," he pleaded. The boy pulled the trigger.